Hello, a very warm welcome to you. Thank you for joining us on what is now episode 18 of the Gita Decoded. We are going rather slowly through chapter 4 because it's very clear to me and to Sister Denise that this chapter contains so much of deep, meaningful information about who God is and what His vocation is in the human world. Sister Denise, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to start on verse 9 and read it in conjunction with verse 10 because it's a continuation of the conversation that Sri Krishna is having with Arjuna. It reads, "He who knows in truth my divine birth and action, having left his body, he is not reborn. He comes to me, Arjuna, thinking solely of me, resorting to me. Many whose greed, fear, and anger have departed, purified by the austerity of knowledge, have attained my state of being." I am aware that your answer is going to be very broad, but what caught my eye in this shloka is having attained my state of being. What state is that?
The state of being of God is God lives in a state of bliss. Incorporeal, immutable, absolutely in bliss, yet absolutely aware of everything that's going on in the human world. And I think that he is saying that a human being who follows all the instructions, who understands the knowledge fully and lives it, can get to that point and be on the same level as God. In Brahma Kumaris, we use the word bap saman, the word saman. So there is the word ap saman, someone like yourself. And then bap saman, to be the same as the father. This is where the question of relationship comes in. You mentioned earlier that relationship is the way to learn. So a person who is in full relationship with God is going to become more and more like God. And it happens in human beings. You with somebody, or even sometimes is a very humorous angle on it, but you know, you have people who have dogs and they live with their dog and they and the dog start to look similar. You've seen photos like that.
Yes, yes.
Because a dog is completely and totally dedicated, a dog as a pet, to the pet owner and just will absolutely absorb everything about that owner and be totally there for it. This is why people make dogs as pets, because they will do that. And what I think that with God and you having a total relationship with each other, and your mind and intellect doesn't go out to anyone else, this, you know, take refuge in me alone. There are these mantras, man mana bhav, mam ekam, all of these means you totally try to be one with God. You cannot become God, but you can become like God. And in fact, in other religious traditions, like in the Christian Bible, for example, it is said that God makes man in his own image. And of course, people have interpreted it physically, that God must look like a man, because a man looks like a man. So therefore, God must be a man. So this is, again, the anthropomorphization of God that people have done. But you can look at it another way, that the qualities of God, the attitude of God, the way in which God experiences himself is transmitted to a person, and that person can become like God in terms of inner state of being, in terms of what you know, in terms of your relationship with what happens in the world. Because after all, you know, God is called also the Father of all souls. And so the relationship, not only between people to God, but also good to people. And God is very interested in humans because there isn't anybody else. So humanity is, you can say, is everything for God. And so God is absolutely invested in causing every human soul to reach their highest potential. You know, and that is really the work of God, the act of God, or the creative energy of God to do that for each and every one of us individually.
The first part of that shloka is also very rich, where God speaks of somebody who's focused on Him and who's has the courage to leave behind common human weaknesses, and He uses the term purified by the austerity of knowledge. I like that expression. Could you tell us how a human being is purified by God's presence? What does that mean?
I think you have to have knowledge from God to know what yoga is. Knowledge is the foundation of yoga. And so that means, okay, the information is you have to consider yourself to be an incorporeal being of light whose essential original condition is absolutely pure and perfect. You are made of purity, peace, power, love, bliss. This is the elemental aspects of a soul, and you have consciousness, and you have to connect yourself with God, who is also like that, but in an unlimited way. So that is the austerity, that you must stay like that. In knowledge, there are many, many instructions about what you have to be, mustn't be, should be, all these things, to be really pure. It's not an austerity like standing on one leg for a year or two, the Hatha Yoga austerities, but in the Brahma Kumaris Raj Yoga knowledge, sometimes you hear the word Gyan Chitta. And chitta is a word that refers to the funeral pyre. And so the funeral pyre of knowledge, going into fire is one of the austerities that people do. They walk on fire, they go into fire, they sit with five fires around them. And there is this expression, Agni Yoga. So the fire of intense spiritual practice is a form of passion. We talked earlier about passion. Now, the passion of sexual passion or the frenzy of killing that occurs in violence is also a passion. And the passion of focusing absolutely on God and going into that bliss, that is also a passion, that is also a fire. So I think there's a connection here where you are sublimating all of your base energies and taking them to their total opposite, and that is the thing that enables you to be purified.
The next verse, Sister Denise, I found to be very touching because it's one of those that's not an intellectual verse, but more a heart verse. In whatever way men take refuge in me, I reward them. Men everywhere, Arjuna, follow my path. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. And in whatever way men take refuge in me. That is kind.
Yes.
What it says to me, Sister Denise, is that all 7 billion of us on the planet, if we remember God for 1 second or 1 nanosecond on any given day, He knows.
Yes.
And that's incredible.
No? It is.
Yeah. So how do you understand this verse, you know, ignoring my gush of emotion?
You know, there is a personal relationship between God and every soul on earth, whether they are theist, non-theist, Buddhist, Christian, Islamic, whatever, it doesn't matter what their religion is, animist, anything, you know, because this is the father and the child. That relationship is couched in some belief system that that soul has adopted. In the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 11th step is about meditation. And a lot of the steps are to do with establishing yourself in communion with God, because it is known that you cannot recover from an addiction without the power of God. Because an addiction is all about being spiritually completely depleted. And they say to the recovering addicts that you have to focus your attention on God in whatever way you understand him, her, it. It could be a tree, it could be whatever you want. And I think this connects very much with this verse. If somebody is raised in a particular faith tradition, in good faith, they will believe God in the way that they have been taught, or they will have their own personal experience. And of course, in a religion as Hinduism, which is a pantheistic religion, people will believe God in a variety of forms. And it is often said that God will appear to the devotee in a vision, and that vision will correspond to how that devotee believes in God, which will compound their faith that, you know, I'm a Christian and I had a vision of Christ, and that proves that Christ is God, as I believe, you see. Whereas a Hindu may believe in God as Ganesha and have a vision of Ganesha, and that will ensure that that person has deepened their faith that this is the form of God. And so God can manifest himself to the devotee in such a way that the devotee really feels, yes, God came to me, and I knew that God was in this form, and God came to me in this form. There are some people, they don't know what form God is in, and they will say, well, I want to know you as you are, and they may experience a vision of light or something very, very subtle, and that will be their experience.
I know what you said earlier about the Vedas being included in aspects of the Bhagavad Gita. This following shloka mentions desiring the success of ritual acts men sacrifice here on earth to the Vedic gods. Quickly, indeed, in the world of men, ritual acts bring success. My question is it advocated that one performs rituals or not?
We can say the Gita will occasionally say you have to leave the Vedas behind. But here it says, no, you must go according to the Vedas. So you have these two strands within the Gita. And I think what we also need to bear in mind, as it's connected with this previous shloka, that someone who really believes in the rituals and the Vedic traditions and so on, and arrives at an experience of God through those, will experience satisfaction through that. So I think a very important thing is to say to yourself and to others that you really cannot say that anyone is wrong. Whatever a person's belief is, that has to be honored. Mm. You know, because we are a world.
That is so big, Denise. That is big.
Well, we're a multiple culture, multiple religion world, and we need to live together. You know, and God will say, well, this is my Christian child, and this is my Buddhist child, and this is my atheist child, and this is my animist child, and they're all his children, and he's fine by that. Why shouldn't we?
I like that. This is my atheist child. That's quite funny. Okay, so if somebody performs rituals for God, God accepts that?
Definitely. You see, it's all part of your relationship with God. And when you are performing rituals in that faith, obviously God is going to experience your faith and give you the reward of your faith. That is the nature of the relationship.
So some choose to be with God with their minds and hearts, and others choose to do for God also within, and God accepts both.
As it says in so many places in the Gita, you know, there are those who come to me through knowledge, there are those who come to me through the yoga of action, there are those who believe in me in the way that they believe in me. So you can see that the Gita is very inclusive in this way.
We now move on to the subject of the four castes, which comes up in verse 13. And it is said, the system of four castes was created by me. Now, Sister Denise, I know you mentioned castes before, and this is a country in which the caste system is practiced. As far as I know, it's not practiced anywhere outside India. I could be wrong about this, but it's very deep set in India. When these words were spoken by God to Arjuna, the system of four castes was created by me. What is he referring to?
You can say created, or you can say defined. And I think I would prefer to take the word defined, because otherwise there is a sense of injustice, that why would God create somebody in this caste and somebody else in that caste? What's the foundation of it? And as far as I can see, everything that God says and does has a logic, and this doesn't fit with the logic. So I prefer to say defined. In the caste system of India, your surname indicates your caste. And so one of the things that was done in Brahma Kumaris was to actually stop using people's surnames. So everyone was called BK so-and-so, Brahma Kumar such-and-such for the brothers, Brahma Kumari such-and-such for the sisters. Because in India, when you meet somebody and you ask them what your name is, you're also telling them what your caste is, and you're also telling them how you should relate to. And I think here, what we're trying to do is to move away from the consequences of karma in such a way that it keeps it fixed. You remember we talked about King Janak as a Raj Rishi, and the thing about King Janak is that he was a Kshatriya as a king, but who was transformed into a Brahmin as a Rishi. So he's an interesting example of somebody who could switch caste. Otherwise, the caste system is such you can't switch caste. And in the modern world, social mobility is considered a very important quality, and it goes together with human rights, ideals, and so on. In the traditional India of the villages and all, whatever caste you're born into, the families regard it that you have to engage to be married somebody of your own caste, you know, and there are castes and subcastes, and it's quite a complex social system. You know, somebody who is born in a very low caste will be sort of excluded from many things, including going to temples and education and so on. So when Gandhi was working, he was also very concerned about the condition of women and the condition of the lower castes. And so he introduced the word Harijan, Harijan meaning the people of God. And one of the descriptions of God is Dinesh, which means Lord of the poor, or Lord of the general people. And there are many, many stories about how God interacts with people of lower caste, much to the consternation of the people of higher caste. So you get a situation where humanity has set up systems that are very rigid, and then God has a whole different system where he's not rigid. So the way I take this verse is that God is saying, okay, according to the type of person that you are, according to what motivates you, according to your standards and principles and so on, we will say that you are such and such caste. So within Brahma Kumaris, we also hear these descriptions like, okay, the highest caste of all is Brahmin. Brahmins need to be pure. Brahmins means you are Brahmacharya, you have to be celibate. You have to perform a lot of regular ablutions. You have to be clean. You have to eat sattvic food. You have to, so many things that are all to do with purity, you know, and your quality of motivation. Everything has to be for the benefit of the world. You have to be not for yourself. You know, and you have to be not interested in making money and this sort of thing, but you want to be a server. And then, you know, a kshatriya will be described as a person who has a great deal of war going on inside their head, this conflict between, you know, the voice of conscience and the voice of desire, and having difficulty reconciling your light side and your dark side, and having to deal with all of that and not being victorious over your sense organs and your sense perceptions, being sometimes victorious, sometimes defeated. And then the Vaishya, the merchant caste, is somebody who is always trying to make deals with God. That, you know, I can't do this practice, but I'll do this, I'll make this donation, and then you sort me out. So there's a very different relationship with God, and then he will say, okay, well, this is a Vaishya type of person. And then the Shudra, the untouchable, the lowest caste, is the person who's absolute hedonist, who is interested only in gratification and not a very high quality person. And so this is how I read it, that I have defined you in this way, and then of course you can shift.
Okay, Sister Denise, I'm going to stop you there. You mentioned in your answer four types of personalities. The way the caste system is practiced is it refers to birth, and this does caste, as mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, refer to the soul or the body?
God is talking to and thinking about souls, not bodies. For God, bodies are objects, and souls are people. That's the way I see it.
Are you saying that this line has been misunderstood?
I think that it's been interpreted in a very physical way, because people are what I call body conscious. And I think what God is doing, you know, when God gives the knowledge of the Gita again, everything has to be rethought from the angle of I'm a soul, not from the angle of I'm a body.
Okay, that's a fresh take on it. I've never equated caste with caste of soul, simply because of the way it's practiced.
Right.
And for centuries. Sister Denise, I'm going to take you to the last line of Shloka 13. which reads, "Know me to be the eternal non-doer." Could you explain what that means? Because the image that I got of God so far from chapter 1 of the Bhagavad Gita up until where we are now is that as far as humanity is concerned, he has a task, a vocation. Any vocation requires action. So what he's saying is, I do not act and I never act. The implication there is that he can't be human because human beings act, but there's more than one level of interpretation of this.
When a person is speaking, they're acting. So if God says, I am not acting, he's acting. Okay. So we have to look at it deeper.
Yeah. Sister Denise, there's one more question I'd like to ask you on Shloka 13, but unfortunately we have run out of time today, so we'll carry it over until the next discussion. I found this particular half hour very interesting and educational because Sister Denise has shared that this is an interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita that is totally different from what has happened historically, especially in India, because caste, according to Sister Denise, refers to the soul and not the body. And what comes to my mind is, do we as human beings have the right to judge another human being and put them into a category? So that stays with me, Sister Denise, and I thank you for your amazing sense of wisdom and your ability to articulate what is contained in the Bhagavad Gita. So thank you for joining us, and I hope to see you soon for the next episode. Thank you and goodbye.